From the Sky News Centre at 6, in the last hour, we've heard American actor Leonard Nimoy, best known for his role as Mr. Spock in Star Trek, has died at the age of 83. He'd been suffering from lung disease. Our reporter Paul Kelso's in Washington. He says while the sci-fi show defined Nimoy's career, he attempted to reshape people's image of him.
Post-Spock, he did try to move on. He directed movies. He directed Three Men and a Baby, something of a departure. He directed some of the Star Trek movies. He wrote poetry, volumes and volumes of it, and some pretty mixed pop music.
Gary Gliss has been sentenced to 16 years in jail for sexually abusing three young girls between 1975 and 1980. The judge said it was clear these 70-year-old's victims were all profoundly affected by the attacks. Lawyers for Sir Cliff Richard have criticised the publication of a letter which revealed a police investigation into the singer had increased significantly in size. They've written to Keith Vaz, the chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee, who received the letter from the head of the South Yorkshire Force. The 74-year-old's described claims of any criminal activity as absurd and untrue. David Cameron's defending the security services after claims they played a part in the radicalisation of the Islamic State militant believed to be Jihadi John. A group which says it was in touch with Mohammed Emwazi before he went to Syria alleges he was subjected to harassment from MI5. The Labour Party wants to cap university tuition fees in England at £6,000 instead of the current £9,000. Ed Miliband says he'd pay for it by reducing pension tax relief for higher earners. Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg had to apologise for going back on his promise to scrap fees, but he isn't a fan of Labour's new pledge.
It'll only benefit the very wealthiest graduates on higher incomes in 20, 30 years' time, and will put at risk the hundreds of millions of pounds that universities currently have to help disadvantaged youngsters.
And we understand Prince Harry will quit the army later this year. It brings to an end a career that included two tours of Afghanistan. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
I do not propose to discuss with you the rights and wrongs of practising the magic art. I will confine myself to saying that I am a practitioner of some experience. Monsieur de Richelieu has no doubt led you to believe that I am thoroughly evil. Such is not the case. In magic, there is neither good nor evil. It is merely a science. The science of causing change to occur by means of one's will.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Enough assault rifles, submachine guns and pistols to equip a guerrilla column of fished out in the Somerset Rhine by 16-year-old lads. But whose are they, the IRA's or NATO's? And as George Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, steps forward as the most likely Republican candidate to oppose Democrat Hillary Clinton at the next US presidential elections, which dynasty will win? Is the American Republic over? USA now just a feudal system, a monarchy in all but name? Well, we look this week at the Bush family's record of collaboration with the Nazis in World War II, and also a little known phenomenon, the tendency for anyone who stands in their way to fall out of the sky and into an early grave in a mystifying succession of plane crashes. We hear from US Naval Intelligence veteran Kenyon Gibson. Also, the Reverend Stephen Sizer is the Surrey vicar who the Anglican Church has banned from using social media or talking about the Middle East, if you can imagine that for a vicar. He's one of Britain's experts, though, on the mainly US phenomenon known as Christian Zionism, and he's written a couple of books on the subject. So what is the Church of England's former oil baron Archbishop Justin Welby? What is it that he doesn't want us to hear? Plus, the 9/11 Commission report didn't even mention the great smoking gun of the 9/11 attacks, that is, the controlled demolition of World Trade Center Building 7, which wasn't even hit by a plane. Now we hear 28 pages of the 9/11 report were also missing. US politicians want them published because they describe the role of Saudi Arabia in the 9/11 attacks. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, and that's where we start this week, Martin. Where do you think we should be looking at? Syria, I think we're going to start, because we've had these three schoolgirls head over there this week. Are they terrorists, or are they victims?
Well, I think that three girls of that age who decide that they're going to go and do something like that are still victims. I can't see them as anything else. The problem is, Tony, that we know, and I don't think there's any doubt about this, that Western intelligence services and the Gulf States intelligence services have been recruiting people all over the world to go and fight in Syria. There's no doubt about it. That's definitely what's been going on. And then suddenly we're told, oh, ISIS are recruiting these people from all over the world and then they're going to come back and kill us. Well, hang on a minute. We know for a fact that MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, have been recruiting people. These people freely go across the border into Syria. The Turkish army made an incursion into Syria this week with an armoured column. They're only able to operate. The Syrian army are about to retake Aleppo, and the Turks are freaking out because they don't want the Syrians to control that border. So, in other words, ISIS is increasingly clear, is essentially a created phenomenon. The Iranians and Iraqi politicians have been saying this, that ISIS is actually receiving arms drops from the British. The Iranians claimed this week that British planes, C-130s, were shot down, two planes, dropping arms to ISIS. Now, that could be Iranian misinformation, but I'm telling you, that's what people in the Middle East are talking about. And if people in this country think that when we say, oh no, we're not doing stuff like that, and the Iranians say, oh yes, you are, that everybody believes us and not the Iranians, then they're the ones who are living in cloud cuckoo land.
What about the spat that's broken out between the Turkish government and the British government over these three girls that have been travelling so-called to Syria? Because they're saying, well, look, if you'd have said something to us, I know you were following them on social media, because what they were doing apparently on Facebook or one of these other social media sites, they were following a known recruiter for Syria, for ISIS, and this person, our security services, GCHQ, MI5, were watching what was going on, and they watched basically from their position of invulnerability behind the scenes up at Cheltenham or wherever, as these girls booked onto planes, went down, and the Turkish are saying, well, look, if you'd have said something, we could have stopped them at the airport.
Well, what's causing tension is that the Turks have been working, they've basically been on the front line, and they're the ones who've been training and pushing these jihadis from all over the world into Syria. And basically, the Turks are annoyed because they have been doing this in cooperation with the CIA and MI6.
Turkish Prime Minister Bülent Arink, I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, but anyway, he said on Monday that Britain only notified Ankara about the missing girls on Friday and described the delay as condemnable, giving them 3 days basically to do what they wanted. The girls, all pupils at Bethnal Green Academy in East London, have been missing for a week after they secretly met up and caught the Turkish Airlines flight from Gatwick Airport to Istanbul last Tuesday. So left 3 or 4 days, and they still didn't tell the Turks to keep an eye on them.
Come back to my initial point. All of these kind of rat lines of jihadis being infiltrated into Syria are being orchestrated by NATO intelligence services along with their allies in the Gulf states of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, there's no doubt about that, but the mainstream media persists in the delusion that somehow ISIS is an independent, crazy organisation that's suddenly getting all these crazy people coming across the world to join it. And of course, then they get virtually simultaneous attacks in all of the Western capitals, in Denmark, in Ottawa, in Sydney, just at the moment when the local politicians are making decisions about whether to reinvade Iraq. It stinks to high heaven. And we know that not 2 years ago, we were absolutely certain what was going on. The NATO intelligence services were recruiting these jihadis from Libya, for example. Abdul Hakim Belhaj has been working with MI6 for donkey's years, infiltrated into Syria to run one of the brigades inside there. And it's all been done by our own intelligence services, who then turn around and say, oh, look, we've got all these jihadis running around all over the place. You'll have to give us some more money to deal with the problem. Well, they are the problem.
I don't know who's overseeing them now, because Sir Malcolm Rifkin, who used to be supposedly, big inverted commas, overseeing the intelligence services, has now resigned. But anyway, it did come up in the House of Commons on Wednesday, and Rushnoor Ali asked about the three girls who have supposedly now on their way to Syria.
Rushnoor Ali! Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, three young women from my constituency left their homes, travelled to Turkey, and now thought to have been smuggled into Syria. Their families are devastated. I know the Prime Minister is making every effort to find them and encourage their return. Will he set up an urgent inquiry into these events to ensure families, schools, mosques, youth clubs, internet companies and all agencies are guided on how they can better protect our young people?
Yeah. Now, I think the Honourable Lady is absolutely right to raise this heartbreaking case, which we also discussed in the House on Monday. Clearly, anyone who saw the parents on the television talking about their children couldn't help be moved by their plight. What I've done is asked the Home Secretary to look urgently with the Transport Secretary at all the protocols we have in place about young people and travelling and what airlines do and what we can do. My understanding is that the police did respond relatively quickly in terms of informing the Turkish authorities, and what the Turkish Deputy Prime Minister has said about a three-day delay is not accurate, but there are always lessons to learn on this occasion. I suspect the lessons will be not just that we can tighten arrangements on aeroplanes and at our borders, but also we all have a responsibility. Schools, parents, families, communities, universities, colleges all have a responsibility to fight this poisonous radicalisation of young people's minds.
Poisonous radicalisation of young people's minds. Now, come back to what I was saying before the clip, Tony. It is definitely the NATO intelligence services working with the Saudis and the Qataris that have organised an international brigade of jihadi fighters to go and fight in Syria. The whole Benghazi incident, if you remember, a couple of years ago.
Over in Libya.
Yes, over in Libya. All of the evidence...
The American ambassador was killed.
That's right. All the evidence suggests that what was involved there is that they were shipping militants and weapons to Syria, and it all blew up in their faces. I mean the Western powers working with their allies, the Saudis and the Israelis, of course, who are basically flying as Al Qaeda's air force inside Syria. That's the reality. At the same time, these people have the barefaced cheek to come out and say this is all orchestrated. It's got two effects. One is to put pressure on the Syrian government. The second is to allow them to make the excuse to stick their finger back into the region. And the third is to frighten the pants off everybody in the West, because all of these people are going to Syria and they're going to come back and eat your babies. And, of course, the whole thing is orchestrated by the intelligence services.
Is it as simple as a resumption of the failed attempt to attack Syria 2 summers ago?
It is indeed. And of course, if we go back to the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, which was a red line according to Obama and Cameron, and that if people did cross this red line, something would have to be done. Seymour Hersh, a very senior US journalist, he's never been wrong about anything.
And Carla Del Ponte at the UN.
They all concluded that in actual fact it was the rebels that had used sarin from Libya. And where have they got it from? They got it from the Western intelligence services, specifically from the Turks working with the Saudis, who of course work with MI6. So we British taxpayers paid for the use of chemical weapons on civilians and then tried to blame it on the Syrian government. And of course, before the war in Syria, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, he's been on the media in France, pointed out that the British approached him at a party and said, we are going to run an armed rebellion in Syria. So in other words, the whole war in Syria may be actually put at the door of MI6. And now we're all weeping crocodile tears about these three unfortunate girls. The whole thing is an absolute travesty.
What about Jihadi John? Because this is another person who apparently was very close to and under surveillance by MI5. It does seem that they don't tend to actually intervene, and the secrecy is used as a cloak for sometimes, in the case of these girls and Jihadi John, doing nothing.
Well, it's not a question of doing nothing. What they're doing is all of these organisations are heavily infiltrated. Anybody who's been anywhere close to this kind of secret world realises that the so-called radical terrorist Islamists are often working for the government. And in fact, Harun Aswat, named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind of 9/11, not 9/11, of 7/7, he was recognised by the Americans as a British agent. So they tried to arrest him several times, and he managed to escape every time because the British sprung him. Now, that's anybody who has any knowledge of what happened in Ireland over 30 or 40 years realises that all of this is orchestrated. There are infiltrators at every level, and a lot of what's going on is perception management for the population
now,
at large.
Mohammed Emwazi, as a Kuwaiti-born British man, is a very mild-mannered guy. This is the effect of this, is to think, well, even the most loving, caring Islamic person. And this is the hideous thing, is that it's all focused on Islam, none on other religions or other faiths, etc. They could be a terrorist.
Well, the whole point is to create an enemy within so that they can then pursue their geopolitical goals. And, of course...
How does creating an enemy within help foreign policy or taking over countries?
Well, no, because in actual fact, most people in Britain, if they were asked, do you want to intervene in Syria, would say no. Not because basically, for the very good reason, we don't really understand what's going on. It's none of our business, and we really shouldn't have... You know, it's up to them to resolve it, which is a fairly straightforward, common-sense view. So they then have to be frightened the pants off. I mean, what happened as a result of the Charlie Hebdo attacks is that the French sent their aircraft carrier, and their aircraft carrier is now bombing. Although, in actual fact, the Iranians and others are suggesting that the bombing of ISIS has been very, very kind of... it's like, almost like a pantomime, and that they're not actually bombing them seriously... and that they're still dropping weapons to them. Now, that's how sophisticated in inverted commas, the Western intelligence operation has become. But the problem for them is that in the days of the internet, all of the facts are out there for those who can be bothered to spend a minimal amount of time looking them up.
I'll give you some facts. James Foley, Abdul Rahman Kassig, Alan Henning, Stephen Sotloff, all beheaded by Jihadi John. So he's not quite such a nice guy, but in actual fact,
all those beheading videos vary, and it's been in the mainstream media, including the Daily Telegraph, etc. et al. And the latest video of the beheading of the Christians, that's been questioned. These videos are very, very well produced, Hollywood-level production, which is very bizarre for a kind of, you know, ragtag terrorist organisation. But at the same time, there's no actual beheading in it, as various experts, like doctors who've watched it, like David Halpin, who's one of the campaigners around David Kelly. Well, there is no beheading in the video. The other thing that the Iranians have picked up on, and I just put it forward, is that virtually all of these people who've supposedly been killed, and maybe they have been killed, all had a background in military intelligence of one kind and another. Now, that doesn't mean anything. One of the ways you carry out these kind of attacks is that you do carry out an attack, but it's the question is who's actually pulling the strings. Other times, you just fake the thing completely. Now, why do we say this? Because NATO has got a track record of this kind of psychological manipulation going back decades, which we will come to, no doubt.
Earlier this month, the militant Jihadi John, actual real name supposedly is Mohammed Emwazi, was featured in a video in which the Japanese journalist Kenji Goto appeared to be beheaded. Hostages released by Islamic State, ISIS, said he was one of three British jihadists guarding Westerners who'd been abducted by the group in Syria. They were known collectively as the Beatles.
Well, yes, and the question is, I ask about all of these things, is ISIS does exist, but who are the paymasters? If they wanted to stop ISIS, they could stop it tomorrow by stopping money, weapons and recruits going to them. But the money, weapons and recruits come from Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Britain.
The British jihadists apparently guarding Westerners who've been abducted by ISIS, being known as the Beatles. It's a bit bizarre, isn't it? This is rather similar to these camps at Guantanamo Bay, where they're called Penny Lane and Strawberry Field. This whole Beatles theme, how does this work as a psychological operation?
Well, what happens is some of the people in Guantanamo were turned in the phraseology, particularly the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Although they were anti-Western, they were convinced to actually become pro-Western.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, there's two sides of the same coin. So Abdul Hakim Belhaj was tortured and imprisoned by the British, but he actually also works with and for the British, because that's what happens. That's what the people become, people are double, triple, quadruple agents, but the ultimate paymasters of all of this have been the usual suspects, and we're not talking about teenage girls in their bedrooms, we're talking about US and British military.
Okay, what about Ukraine? Because I noticed one of the stories yesterday, three Spaniards have been arrested for going to fight out in the east of Ukraine along with the rebels this time. So, you've got people leaving Britain fighting with all different sides. I mean, actually, some of them possibly going to join the Ukrainian army.
Well, I mean, in actual fact, the British have now said that they're going to send 75 guys to train the Ukrainian National Guard. The Ukrainian National Guard is...
So that's both sides. Let's deal first with the one you've just mentioned, which is the British army training the Ukrainian army.
Well, they're not training the Ukrainian army. They're going to train the Ukrainian National Guard, I understand, which is like the British army training the Ulster Defence Association, because that's basically what they are. They are not actually a real military formation. They're a paramilitary formation with political links. So they're either run by some of them are run by big oligarchs like Kolomoisky, and some of them are run by openly fascist people like Andrei Paribin.
Some kind of private army they're going to train.
Well, exactly, yes.
Paramilitary.
Yes. And at the same time, they're moaning that other people are volunteering to fight for the other side. But, of course, the same process is going to take place in Ukraine, I fear, as we've seen in Syria. But a much more dangerous process, because, of course, the Russians can bite back and bite back hard.
Is it possible to say, well, we people can go and fight on one side or not the other side?
Well, I think ultimately what we need to do is have a solution, and the glimmer of a solution is there because of the movement that's come from Germany and France.
Are you talking about the movement of armour, for example, and troops and things?
No, I'm talking about political movement, yeah?
Because apparently the existing NATO states in the Baltic, they're being reinforced from
there was a very provocative march on the Estonian Independence Day, which involved British and US troops 300 metres from the Russian border. This is provocative in the extreme, and all the rhetoric that's been used. The Russians have been very careful,
Martin,
to speak very calmly throughout the crisis.
As a whole, in Kiev, the new government in Ukraine decides that it wants to join NATO. What's to stop them?
Well, nothing really, but they can't make the people in the East Ukraine join, and they won't.
They do want to join NATO. The only thing stopping them is NATO is umming and ahhing.
Because the NATO treaty means that you've got to go to war on their behalf. And this government is, in fact, I mean, there's been massive war crimes in East Ukraine. Use of phosphorus shells. I mean, John McCain, the big warmonger in the US, admitted that the Ukrainian forces were using cluster bombs, and he said it's really unfortunate that they're using cluster bombs. That's because we haven't supplied them with any more modern weaponry. But he admitted they were using cluster bombs, and they're no doubt using cluster bombs with the advice and support of their NATO friends and supporters, which means that our guys are actually complicit in all of the war crimes going on
okay.
in East Ukraine.
Give us your crystal ball. What's going to happen in Ukraine then?
Well, I hope that the Russians have played them to checkmate and we'll get some kind of freezing of the crisis. But I fear with capitalism basically in its in a very dangerous corner that there are definitely forces within the United States that want a full-on confrontation with Russia, because they'll use that as the excuse for why the banks collapse again.
I mean, we've seen the withdrawal of heavy artillery, for example, this week, haven't we, from Ukraine, which is good, surely.
Yes, and I think that people should the efforts that have been made by the Russian government and by, to some extent, the Germans and the French to try and take the heat out of the crisis are to be supported. The danger, the problem is that the US has got a long-term strategy of undermining the Russian state completely, and they want to use this as a way of trying to bog the Russians down in the same way as they did in Afghanistan in the 80s.
Okay, let's wind up then with a listen to a US journalist who used to work for, I think, for the US government, one of the big committees on the US government, but he's now based in Kiev, a sort of runaround, and his name is Jim Davis from Kiev, and this is some coverage last week on 5 Live. A couple of minutes, Martin, and we'll let you see what you make of what Jim Davis has got to say about his analysis of what's going on in Ukraine.
Well, first of all, with all due respect to your last guest, having lived with this situation, or lived in Ukraine and the former Soviet Union on a constant basis for over 20 years now, I have to put myself in a position of totally disagreeing with the professor. What you have to understand, in my opinion, is that there's always been a feeling in Russia in recent years that somehow the USSR was a good time for them, a better time for them, in many ways, utterly determined to, if you will, roll back what we consider the gains of the end of the USSR. And quite frankly, Vladimir Putin plays into that. He plays that that music very well, and they listen and they like it. And to me, the worrisome thing is, quite honestly, after watching this day in, day out, writing about it, listening to it, examining it, reading the history, I am totally and absolutely without any doubt convinced that the United States, Europe, and what we think of as the free world has a choice. We will fight Mr. Putin and the Russians now, when we might have some advantage, or we will fight them later in a less advantageous situation. I do not think the professor's idea about diplomacy, we've seen diplomacy. Diplomacy means opportunities for Mr. Putin to lie more, and quite frankly, lying has become an absolute tool of quote-unquote diplomacy. He'll agree to anything, as we saw in Minsk. But then what does he do? Something entirely different, and we allow him to get away with it. So at some point, Mr. Obama, Ms. Merkel, Mr. Hollande, and others are going to have a choice. Listen to the lies, call his bluff, and put some boots on the ground and do what must be done to stop this man, what boundaries should be. Because if we don't, the new Berlin Wall will be somewhere near Brussels.
Jim Davis there in Kiev, Martin.
Well, I mean, the delusions involved in that speech are extraordinary. And, of course, the lies largely have been told by the West. For example, the shootings in the Maidan Square, probably carried out by private sector, the shooting down of the MH17
plane. But hang on, he's right. He's right. Surely, if there is a confrontation, we may end up with Russian tanks in Brussels.
No, I think if the Russians wanted to invade Ukraine, they could have taken it. They've got plenty of forces there. They could have taken it just like that if they wanted to. They don't want to. They're bending over backwards to try and avoid a full-out confrontation. The real test now is whether the Western European leadership, particularly the German leadership, is going to have its own national interests trodden underfoot by the United States of America, because that's what's going on. And eventually, of course, they may in fact decide correctly that it makes more sense for them to line up with Putin against US and Britain.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Onto the arms cache discovered last weekend, I think it was, by some young lads, sort of 16-year-olds out magnet fishing near a place called Grey Lake, which is just near Bridgewater on the Somerset Levels, Martin. 80 weapons found, just about everything you can possibly imagine. The Widowmaker, the Armalite, the AK-47 automatic. We're talking about basically assault rifles, pistols, and as well as machine guns, submachine guns, and rifles. Pretty much everything you could wish to equip a guerrilla column of around about 80, between 80 and 100 men.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously...
Fished up from the river.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously an arms cache by a fairly well-connected organisation of one kind or another.
It's been suggested the IRA, so what are your thoughts about...
It's potentially possible. I mean, they used to have far more weaponry than they ever knew what to do with. I mean, once the British had bombed Libya, the Libyans supplied them with virtually anything they wanted. And the variety of the weaponry suggests a non-formal structure. But, of course, the Gladio networks, which were operating in the Western Europe since the 1940s, they were based around these arms dumps, which were placed in secret caches and then used by NATO intelligence services to carry out terrorist attacks, for example, like the Brabant massacre in Belgium, in which large numbers of people in supermarkets were shot dead at random, and then the guns used were planted on the international communist current.
Well, what I was quite interested to see was the disinformation put out by even Somerset Police about this. First of all, saying they were World War II weapons. Well, as far as I know, an Armalite is not World War II, and neither is an AK-47. So they weren't doing their spotting the right correctly. Also, the number of the weapons, the police saying it was 40. The lads that picked them up said there were 80 weapons roughly that they got. They're being a little bit disingenuous from the cops, might be just to sort of play the whole thing down. And also the possibility that maybe if the lads hadn't found these, that they would have fallen into the hands of organised criminals. I mean, what on earth are any organisations doing leaving these massive arms caches? I can imagine kids right across the country now thinking, this is great fun, let's go and trawl all the rivers around our area with magnets.
Well, yes, but I mean, as I say, it's not just
kids, organised crime as well.
Well, on balance, I would suggest this is more likely than not a lost PRI arms cache. But of course, arms caches were used by NATO. And the point about those arms caches is they would be as varied as this.
Really, would you have 100 IRA people needing to be equipped?
Well, would you have 100 people who needed to attack the Brabant the police station in Belgium as part of the Brabant massacres? The point is, of an arms cache, is you don't take it all out at once, and you have a variety of weaponry so that you can create the effect you want to create.
The other thing is, of course, it was found with a magnet, so you won't be finding the ammunition, which is lead bullets and brass cartridges. You won't be finding them with the magnet, so that's probably still under there if MI5 frogmen haven't already got it out. But also, C4 plastic explosives was in these caches too.
Was it in this particular cache?
No, not in this one, but it's in the gladio caches. Let's just remind people that the gladio caches have been discovered in countries across Europe. They've said officially, this is through the parliamentary inquiries, there are 140 at least across Europe of these caches. Two certainly before have been discovered, which were definitely identified as gladio caches. One is the in Italy near... up in the, I think it was near Trieste, and another one in Velt, I think it's called, a town in Holland.
Well, I think the use of C4 explosive is an extremely good indicator that it would be a gladio cache in that case, because this is basically
that was the other cache, not this one.
This is NATO plastique.
These kids didn't find any explosives because they weren't given the chance.
The IRA's plastique was Semtex, which originated in the Czech Republic and came via Libya, but NATO's plastique is C4, and of course it was originally said after the 7/7 bombings, a French policeman gave an off the record comment saying, well, we're really worried about this because they use C4 explosive, not this TTP, which they claimed that were in the rucksacks made of peroxide. Good old fashioned NATO issue C4.
Okay, now the significance of the incredible wide range of different types of weapons for different caliber guns and different caliber ammunition. Now, certainly there was two roles, wasn't there, for the NATO Operation Gladio caches. One was for stay behind forces. So you can imagine if we had a Soviet occupied Britain, that a force would be got together and these guns would be dug up to be doing sabotage and things like that against an occupying army. Now it would be very handy, wouldn't it, to have Soviet weapons, Eastern European weapons, because if you're holding up and managing to grab ammunition off the occupying forces, you will need weapons which to use those in. But also, of course, with the Gladio terrorist operations, which was the other way that these caches were used in other parts of Europe, particularly Italy and Belgium, used for terrorist attacks, it enables you to pick and choose which kind of weapon you want to be used in a specific so-called, fake terror attack.
Yeah, because and therefore when you use it making a fake terror attack, you want to create a certain kind of impression about the weaponry being used. It's all about perception management. So, if, for example, you might want to use Soviet-style weaponry to suggest that these people had been armed by the Soviet Union, even though they weren't. It's more about perception management than anything else, and the ballistics would then point in certain directions rather than others, and so on.
Okay, well, let's just to remind ourselves a bit about Gladio, let's have a listen to just a summary of what it was all about from, I suppose, the world expert on it, looking down from his Swiss mounted top on the rest of us, is Professor Daniele Ganser, and here he is talking to the website The Mind Renewed, explaining basically what is Gladio all about. Martin, you explain.
Well, Gladio is the code name, the Italian code name for these stay-behind structures, which were created initially in the 1940s. And insofar as the elected politicians knew what was going on, they were told that they were there as a kind of an insurance policy if the Soviets invaded and they needed to set up a sort of alternative army.
During the Cold War, you had the military secret service, and this secret service had a branch which was called Gladio. So it's a top secret part of the secret service which was preparing to fight in case of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. So an invasion of Italy, of France, of Germany, of Denmark, etc., of Norway, Switzerland. This secret network of soldiers would have fought as a guerrilla army, in the sense, you know, that they fight behind enemy lines, they would have their arms caches with explosives, with weapons, with ammunition, and also with communication gear. So, you know, in the case that you had NATO pilots shot down above Soviet-occupied France, you would have the NATO secret army guerrillas giving information to governments abroad, probably in the US, on occupied territory, about the shot down pallets. So, you know, it was very much along this idea of resistance. That was one branch.
So was it actually inspired by the resistance movements in World War II, was it?
That's true, very much so. In fact, I've had a few people in Norway who said, you know, we were occupied by the Germans during World War II. And when World War II was over in 1945, our aim was to prepare for a new war. And that would have been the war against the Soviet Union. And in order to be really ready for that war, we did not only have a regular army, so the, you know, the soldiers that are controlled by the defense department, but we also had a second, like a secret group, which would fight even when the normal army would have declared defeat.
The danger, of course, is, Martin, that these are completely outside, these weapons, outside democratic control, even though they are supposedly part of the military.
Well, all the evidence shows that NATO, these secret NATO structures did use these weapons to engage in terrorism, largely against innocent civilians. The most serious incident of which was probably the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980 that killed 86 people. A higher death toll, it might be said, than 7-7. But of course, given the history of NATO intelligence's previous misbehaviour, and that nobody has been punished for any of this, we are absolutely entitled to presume or to question what's going on when things like 7-7 happen, as we have.
Do you think it's time that British military intelligence told the public whereabouts these caches are and actually brought them in, so there aren't these arms just lying around in the countryside?
Well, ultimately, we may need some kind of truth and reconciliation commission like in South Africa. But first of all, we've got to start arresting some of the real terrorists, and I'm afraid they're inside the structure.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
The 9/11 Commission report didn't even mention the smoking gun of the 9/11 attacks, that is, the controlled demolition of Building 7. That building wasn't even hit by a plane. It was part of the World Trade Center. But now we hear that 28 pages of the 9/11 Commission report were missing, redacted. US politicians, at least some of them, want them published because they describe the role of the Saudi Arabian government in the attacks. And I'm joined now by Fran Scott from Reinvestigate 9/11. Hi, Fran. Welcome to
Hi
the Politics
there.
Show.
Hi there, Tony.
Now, tell us a bit about this. The latest news on 9/11, because this is amazing that you've got a massive amount of information. Well, it's 28 pages is quite a bit on the Saudi role, and yet we're not allowed to know anything about it.
Well, exactly, Tony. And these pages, they're redacted, and they were a US Senate report on the 9/11 attacks written in 2002 and kept secret by President George Bush. And in September 2014, three US senators were allowed to go and look at them, but they were not allowed to take any notes. And they came out of there and did a press conference, and they're absolutely shocked because what they saw in those redacted pages was that it contradicted the 9/11 Commission completely, and it showed very definite Saudi government links with 9/11 hijackers. And Senator Bob Graham said that this is a cover-up and a betrayal of the 9/11 families. And the 9/11 families are now suing the Saudi government in court. That's still in progress at the moment.
Oh, hang on a minute, though, because surely what's happening is they're trying to shift the blame onto the Saudis, even though it's blank bits of paper that we don't know on them. Isn't this just another load of scapegoating?
Well, yes, I quite agree with you, Tony, because nobody's been raising the issue of the CIA and FBI involvement. I mean, we know from a lot of whistleblowers that have come out and said that the top brass would always block their investigations into the 9/11 hijackers. For instance, the CIA and FBI were tracking Al-Qaeda for years. They were doing data mining with their computer systems. And we know from Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaffer that there was a secret Pentagon operation called Able Danger, which was tracking Al-Qaeda and even identified Mohammed Atta and several of the 9/11 hijackers and were tracking their movements, intercepting their communications whilst they were in the US. And those Able Danger files were shredded, first of all, in 2000 and again in 2004.
Got shredded in both directions, maybe. One cross and one up and down. Anyway, this is a long time ago, Fran. Is it still any point in trying to do something about this? If so, what can we do?
Well, there's a lot of people that are supporting an independent reinvestigation into the 9/11 attacks because there's so many contradictions of the official version. It's just full of holes.
Now, I personally would recommend Dylan Avery's film Loose Change, which is about 2 hours long. Have you any other films that you think that actually are quite good ways of looking at 9/11 from, I suppose, from a not from a conspiracy point of view, but from a professional point of view, for example, with the architects that have looked at the way the buildings collapsed, that kind of thing?
Yes, well, if you go on the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth website, Richard Gage, who's the founder of that, he's got a DVD called 9/11 Experts Speak Out, and that's got lots of professional people, engineers, architects, demolition experts, physicists, scientists, academics, lawyers, everybody's there speaking out about why they think the 9/11 official version just cannot be true. And Richard Gage is actually coming to the UK for a little mini tour. If you want information,
he's going to be here in Bristol, isn't he, in April?
Yeah. If you want more information, go on reinvestigate911.org website.
Okay, so that's www.reinvestigate911.org. Fran Scott, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you, Tony.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, the Reverend Stephen Sizer, you probably remember him. He's the vicar who was banned from talking about the Middle East or going onto social media because he linked to an article called 9/11 Israel. Israel did it? I think it's in the title of it. Anyway, implicating the state of Israel as part of the 9/11 attacks. But anyway, he's been banned now from using social media or talking to the Middle East. But he's done a lot of talking about it in the past because he's an expert on Christian Zionism, this phenomenon being imported from the United States. So what exactly is the Church of England stopping him talking to us about? Let's have a listen to Stephen Sizer, the Reverend from Virginia Water in Surrey now.
Let me ask you one or two questions to warm you up. Why is there such a close relationship between the Christian right, the political establishment, and the state of Israel? Why, after 40 years, does Israel continue to occupy parts of Lebanon, the Sheba Farms, Syria, the Golan Heights, and Palestine, the West Bank, while Syria has been pressured to withdraw from Lebanon? Why is Israel able to develop and hold chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, disregarding every international agreement and treaty, while Iran is threatened with a preemptive strike for seeking to obtain nuclear technology? Why has Israel been the subject of more UN resolutions than any other country in the world, and why has America vetoed virtually every single one of them? Why will you not find a single serving US politician critical of Israel? Not one. Why has Britain and America become the focus of so much hatred in the Arab world and the target of Islamic terrorists, despite our commitment to international law, democracy, and human rights? Well, the answers to these questions will remain unanswered if we fail to factor in what I believe is the most influential, powerful, and destructive movement within the Christian Church today, Christian Zionism. Let me define it first of all. Christian Zionism is essentially a political and theological movement within largely Protestant evangelical Christianity that views the modern state of Israel as mandated by God, the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and therefore we should support it morally, economically, politically, unconditionally. Christian Zionists are convinced that God blesses nations and individuals that stand with Israel and curses those that don't. Christian Zionism provides a biblical justification for greater US intervention militarily in the Middle East. It's deeply mistrustful of the UN, the European community. It demonizes Islam. It opposes the implementation of international law and the peace process in the Middle East. Now, we need to distinguish three things: Judaism, Israel, and Zionism. Judaism is a religion, Israel is a nation, Zionism is a political system. As a religion, I respect Judaism. As a nation, I recognize Israel. But as a political system, I repudiate Zionism, repudiating both anti-Semitism and Zionism, which I believe is inherently racist. Let me give you a flavor of the movement. A speech by John Hagee. Hagee is the founder and senior pastor of Cornerstone Church, San Antonio, Texas. 18,000 members, nearly as many people who are here at Greenbelt, attend his church on a weekly basis, so it's a pretty influential church in Texas. His sermons and his lectures go out on 160 TV stations, 50 radio stations, and with an estimated audience of 99 million homes worldwide on a weekly basis. So he's an influential guy. Last year, he admitted, for 25 years, I have been pounding the evangelical community over television. The Bible is a very pro-Israeli book. If a Christian admits I believe the Bible, I can make him a pro-Israel supporter, or they have to denounce their faith. So I have the Christians over the barrel, you might say. The assumption Hagee makes that Bible-believing Christians will be pro-Israel is the dominant view in America today. In March 2007, Hagee was a guest speaker at the AIPAC conference, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. He began with these words. The sleeping giant of Christian Zionism has awakened. There are 50 million Christians standing up and applauding the state of Israel. The Jerusalem Post pointed out his speech did not lack clarity. He went on to say, it is 1938, Iran is Germany, Ahmadinejad is the new Hitler, we must stop Iran's nuclear threat and stand boldly with Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. Think of our future together, 50 million evangelicals joining in common cause with 5 million Jewish people in America. It's a match made in heaven.
That's the Reverend Stephen Sizer from Virginia Water in Surrey, who's been banned by the Anglican Church for speaking the words he was just speaking there about the Middle East. And now we're going to have a look at the US elections with Jeb Bush in the running for standing as the Republican nominee. Let's have a listen now to a talk by Kenyon Gibson, an interview I did with him a few years ago, about the incredible number of people who've stood in the way of the Bush family and ended up dead in plane crashes.
My name is Kenyon Gibson. I come from America and used to work in the U.S. Navy. I did intelligence operations in and around Guantanamo Bay. After I left the Navy, I've done some what they call PSYOPs, psychological warfare, in busting drug dealers in 1993 to 1994. Recently, I've written a book that a few government agencies in America might not be too happy about, and that's called Common Sense, a study of the Bushes, the CIA, and the suspicions regarding 9/11. Presently, it's only available in Arabic.
Can you take us through some of the suspicious deaths, particularly plane crash deaths, that have been associated with Bush Sr. and George W.? People who maybe are a threat to the Bush family have met their ends through plane crashes.
Well, that is one suspicious angle, Tony. We could start with a guy named Bin Laden, in this case, Salem Bin Laden. He flew his plane into power lines after taking off from Earl May Field in 1979 in Texas. The owner of the airstrip said he was a very experienced pilot. We just couldn't understand why he decided to go right instead of left.
What way was he connected with the Bush family?
Oh, they were friends. They were buddies. They were business buddies. Bin Laden used to come to Texas quite a lot. A lot of people don't realize that, but the Bushes and the Bin Ladens were just, I mean, they were very, very close, the whole family. There's corroboration of that. If you read Kathy O'Brien's book, Transformation of America, there's quite a lot of interaction between the Saudi royals, rich Saudi business people, and the Bush family.
What about the guy that flew into the power lines? Was he some kind of threat to the Bush family?
Well, we don't actually know why. He did invest quite a lot of money. He was there. He was just one person there. He's one less person to tell the story, put it that way. He's one of many, though. I think he's the only Saudi Arabian to suffer such a fate. Most who suffered were Bush's fellow Americans, and including a number of politicians like Nick Begich, who was a Democrat. Nick was flying with Hale Boggs, who was a congressman who was working on the Warren Commission and had stated that the FBI was lying about Kennedy's death. His plane disappeared in Alaska on the 16th of October in 1972, and the CIA just claimed that the plane could never be found. Maybe it wasn't meant to be found. You know, how can you not find a plane these days with all the technology you have? But that's what the CIA claimed. Then there was Ron Brown, Commerce Secretary in 1996. His plane crashed on the 3rd of April that year. Now, he had a lot of connections to Enron. That's an issue nobody really wants to talk about much, is it? So we don't know what he knew. He died with his knowledge. Another person to die with his knowledge was Gary Caradore, who was a state investigator from Nebraska who was connecting the dots between the Bushes, Larry King, and child abuse at high levels in government. His plane crashed on 11th of July 1990 along with his 8-year-old son, and he had been developing a lead to the top politicians in America at the time. So he disappeared, his notes disappeared, and I guess we're not supposed to ask any questions on that. That bit of information can be found, by the way, in a book written by a Republican politician, John DeCamp, and it was just so sordid, the whole investigation, that, you know, there are a number of Republicans in America who aren't working on all these evil Iran-Contra schemes. And, you know, I think it goes to show that, hey, this wasn't some left-wing politician out to get the Bushes. This was one of his own people who was connecting the dots. And Senator John DeCamp was finding that a lot of people were coming to him and saying, hey, you know, the Bushes are involved in pedophile scandals. And he was able to document that very well. But anyway, you're asking about deaths and plane crashes. Let's stick to that. And let's get to Mel Carnahan, who perished in a plane crash while running against John Ashcroft for a Senate seat in Missouri. That was on the 16th of October 2000. Now, ironically, the state put his widow on the ballot, and she beat Ashcroft. Then another Democrat to perish was George W. Collins, who perished on the 8th of December 1972 in a plane crash at Chicago's Midway Airport. Somebody from another country was Amora da Costa, Portugal's defense minister. He had been planning to disclose documents related to the Iranian arms deals in 1980. He never got to do so as his plane went down on the 4th of December 1980. He is one of many, and there'll be other names on the list, who were investigating Iran-Contra. Jake Horton was an American. He got into his jet on the 10th of April 1989. He was actually going to discuss illegal campaign contributions made by an Enron official in Florida. His trip lasted 10 minutes. John Hines, just a moment ago I was talking about the investigation into Iran-Contra. John Hines was one of those people investigating that. His plane experienced trouble. When it did, they called for a helicopter to come and look at the plane because they thought the landing gear was defective. The helicopter ended up crashing into the plane on the 4th of April, 1991. Incidentally, John Hines was then married to Teresa Hines, who is now married to John Forbes Kerry. Dorothy Hunt died in a United Airlines plane crash in 1972. Along with her were a number of others who might have embarrassed the Nixons and Bushes. She herself was a CIA operative and the wife of Howard Hunt, a suspect in the Kennedy assassination. John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane was to crash on the 16th of July 1996 with many of his family members on board. It had been released unofficially that he was going to enter politics. So, you know, one more dead Kennedy. Mickey Leland, on the 7th of August 1989, died in a plane crash in Ethiopia. Now, Leland was one of the best politicians America had. He was a caring man. He was from Texas, but he was a Democrat, and he really tried to make a change in America and around the world, and he certainly criticized the Bushes on occasion, so his death at least indirectly benefited them. Jerry Litton, a representative in Missouri, was on the way to celebrate winning the Democratic nomination, but he never got there. His plane went down on the 3rd of August, 1976. Now, we come to something that's very familiar for anyone from the UK, and that's Lockerbie. There are many people who think that the U.S. Detonated the bombs on that plane. That was Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on the 4th of December, 1998. Charles McKee was on board, and he was part of an investigating team that had been connected some dots between the CIA and a rogue unit called Korea, which had links to terrorists. His mother was to tell Time magazine, "I've had a feeling that if Chuck hadn't been on the plane, it wouldn't have been bombed." Along with them were several other investigators. Now, it's convenient to blame Libya. Libya has paid some money in relation to this. Libya has also made a statement saying, "Yes, we paid money, but that's not to say that we did this." Now, related to 9/11, we come to a pilot named Sten Molin. He was the pilot of American Airlines Flight 587. That plane crashed on the 12th of November, 2001, over Long Island. It destroyed the homes of a number of New York City firemen when it did. And he had been in the air control tower on 9/11, and he had expressed doubts about the official story. so we don't get to hear what he had to say. I believe what he had to say was that there was a lack of transponder codes going back from the so-called hijacked planes, and that opens up a whole line of inquiry as to what really went on. Were those planes remotely controlled? Stephen Mostow met his death in the air when he was flying in Colorado on the 24th of March 2002. He was a microbiologist. That may well have to do with the 9/11 investigation or the related anthrax investigation, the anthrax shenanigans that happened right after 9/11. And for some reason, there's been a plethora of deaths of microbiologists, especially those who had to do with human DNA and targeted bacteria, that is genetically targeted bacteria. But that's getting a little off this. Let's stay on the track of people who died while in the air. We have a Republican next, Larkin Smith. He's from Mississippi. He died on the 5th of August, 1989. His plane crashed in that state. He was investigating the deaths of five Green Beret colonels who had been involved in CIA drug running in South America. John Tower was another Republican. He was from Texas. He was investigating the Iran-Contra affair and headed up the Tower Commission. He died on April 5th, 1991. Now, we go to Panama, and we look at General Omar Torrijos. This man was a friend of Graham Greene, the man about whom Graham Greene wrote a book called Getting to Know the General. He was very popular in Panama and in many circles. He had a real vision and an understanding of Panama, and he did a lot to improve things, and he did a lot to stop unwanted CIA influence, including drug running. He died on the 31st of July, 1981. After that, the U.S. was able to move in Manuel Noriega, so we see how the U.S. came out of that. Paul Wellstone, he was a very popular Democrat senator from Minnesota. He died in a plane crash on 25th October 2002. That was 11 days before the American elections. That was a very key death because he died, and along with him, his wife, daughter, and several aides. So the Democrats were not able to put his wife on the ballot as they were in the when Mel Callahan perished on a plane crash in another state. The Republican challenger was able to win, and when he did, it broke the tie in the Senate, or the House. I'm not sure if he was a congressman or a senator. Sorry about that. That was just extremely decisive and very timely. It is kind of suspicious that the woman investigating the crash, Carol Carmody, had formerly worked for the CIA and had worked on the investigation of Senator Carnahan's crash.
The incredible list of people there dying in plane crashes. One would think that anyone who's a political campaigner would never want to get into an aircraft.
There are political campaigners who have made that decision. That's a very wise decision. We note the decision of Chavez from Venezuela, who, when he was in the United States, refused to fly on a certain plane, stating that he felt CIA sabotage had been involved, and he certainly had reason to know. He basically caught the CIA in a coup in Venezuela, and the American embassy doesn't even deny it. The American embassy was ridiculing him in very racist overtones. Ironically, when they were ridiculing him, using a monkey as a metaphor for him, Colin Powell was in attendance at the American embassy. It was just one embarrassing scene after the Americans had been caught in a CIA coup trying to displace Chavez, because Chavez was not going to play ball and give them the oil percentages that they wanted.
Kenyon Gibson, their former naval intelligence officer, about the Bush family plane crash. It's time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 time, followed by Mohammed and his Arabian Nights. A sister show, Dialect, is on Mondays at 11, thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour councillors from Southmead, Jenny Smith. I'm online at thisweek.org.uk. You'll find links to these various stories, and you can follow me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I'm wishing you now a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the actor Leonard Nimoy, best known as Mr. Spock from Star Trek, has died at the age of 83. Barry Weir reports.
He won generations of fans with his role as the Half-Vulcan first officer of the Starship Enterprise.
Live long and prosper.
The star died after suffering from lung disease. He didn't always speak highly of the role he got in the mid-60s, but he did return for cameos in the recent Star Trek revamps. He was also a director, poet and singer. His last tweet on Monday was a poignant one. It said, "A life is like a garden. Perfect moments can be had, but not preserved, except in memory."
Former glam rock singer Gary Glitter has been jailed for 16 years after being convicted of historical sex attacks on three schoolgirls. A judge said he'd shown no atonement for what he'd done. Sir Cliff Richard's lawyers have criticised a committee of MPs for publishing a letter about the police investigation into allegations against the singer. It emerged earlier this week that it had expanded in size. The 74-year-old strongly denies any wrongdoing. The Prime Minister's defended the security services as they face criticism for not revealing what they knew about the Islamic State killer known as Jihadi John.
"I think they are incredibly impressive, hard-working, dedicated, courageous and effective at protecting our country. All of the time, they're having to make incredibly difficult judgments, and I think basically they make very good judgments on our behalf."
The militant's been widely identified as Mohammed Emwazi from West London. David Cameron insists Britain will do everything it can to track down those who've committed terrorist acts. The Conservatives and Lib Dems say plans by Labour to slash university tuition fees in England haven't been properly costed and are unachievable. Ed Miliband's announced he wants to reduce them from £9,000 to £6,000 a year. And the price of first and second class stamps is increasing by a penny. Royal Mail says they'll rise to 63 and 54 pence respectively from the end of March. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.